Okay.
Here we go.
Okay. So the new reader began to write and Bill and question him about what did it mean having what is a spiritual experience? You know, if you're going to have one of those things, you got to have it seemed kind of lofty or beyond your reach. And it was, most readers were confused about it. So when Bill republished the second edition of the first printing, he put that asterisk in there, and they put these appendix in the back of the book to explain what is a spiritual experience. So there's a great, it's hardly impossible to understand that chapter if we don't understand page 569, which is in the back of the book, which deals with spiritual experience. It tells you what is a spiritual experience. Now, if you're going to have one of these things, you ought to know about what it is.
Might be a good idea, Matt.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. In the first 16 prints of the book, that asterisk was not there.
Uh-uh.
Page 569 was not in the back of the book, so it just left you hanging that you got to have a spiritual experience. So he said it fully explained on Appendix 2, which is page 569. Later on, he's referring to the asterisk again. He said on page 27, for further information, see page 569. On page 47, it said, please see page 569. Must be very, very important. Let's go to page 569 now and just see what he was talking about.
Yeah. Spiritual, the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening, I use many times in this book. In this book, we're going to use two terms many times, spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. There are two ways that we're going to can recover. One is a spiritual experience, which we find is very sudden and quick. And one is a spiritual awakening, which is very gradual and occurs over a period of time. Which, upon careful reading, and a lot of alcoholics don't do very careful reading. Show that the personality changes sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism and manifests itself in us in many different forms. It occurs in many different forms under these two headings. One is quick and one is slow. In fact, Bill goes on to say there are many personality changes as there are personalities in AA. You know, God's going to work with us uniquely, but they're either quick or sudden. Yet it's true that in our first printing, the first book, this is a book that we didn't have an asterisk in it, gave many readers the impression that these personality changes are a religious experience, must be in the nature of a sudden, spectacular upheaval. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. You know, the reader got the impression that everybody had to have the same type of recovery that Bill had. In fact, I first read the book and got it before anybody told me about Appendix 2. I felt the same way. I was waiting for something to zap me like Bill got zapped. And everybody wants to get zapped. And I was waiting for all that to happen. It never did happen, so I began to wonder about it. Okay. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Bill's recovery is described as sudden. Though it's not our intention to create such impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. You know, everybody wants to have the change like Bill had. And that's what I was looking for, and that's what I thought I was supposed to have. Said, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformation, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experience are what psychologist William James called the education variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of this phenomenon before he himself. Most of us will not have the sudden spiritual experience like Bill. Most of us will have the education where we will change gradually as we learn and apply the steps. This is the average recovery. Mine happened to be the plain garden variety change. Other people noticed change long before I did myself. Other people used to tell me in the weeks in the program, first 6-7 weeks, how good I was doing. I didn't think I was doing any better at all. Say, you're doing all right. And I kept on doing what I was supposed to do. There was never no sudden change. Okay. Long before he finally realized that he had undergone a profound alteration in his reactions in life. And I finally realized that I had undergone a profound alteration in my reactions to life. I didn't react to life. Things that I became aware. That's awakening, is when you become aware of the change. I became aware of a few changes. I knew that I didn't bring about this myself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. The sudden spiritual experience was sudden, but this took a few months. With few exceptions, I remember finding that they have tapped. When we realize that we have changed, we realize that we have tapped into an inner resource which we presently identify with our own conception of power greater than themselves. When I realize that, I realize I have tapped into a power greater than is God, which is a power greater than myself. Most of us think this awareness of this power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience, the same value of spiritual experience. For the sudden, one is no better than the other. A sudden spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, they both do the same thing. They both bring about a personality change sufficient to recover. Now, when Bill put this in, he changed the 12-step. The 12-step used to say, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, in the original Red Book. Now, when he realized most people will not have that spiritual experience, their spiritual experience is kind of rare. Most people will have spiritual awakenings. So the 12 step was changed to say have to have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We are more apt to have a spiritual awakening than a spiritual experience. Very few people have seen spiritual experience in the fellowship, but it is that rare. I've been fortunate to be around long enough, work with enough people that have seen four or five of them, and they are very rare. And they don't occur in very often. But the people I noticed that had them were very, very, very sick people. Now God reached a little further to give these people this change.
He said, most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery. But these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation. When I first came to AA, I held all things religious or spiritual in absolute, complete contempt. I knew so much about God and spirituality that was wrong, I damn near didn't learn anything that was right, and I almost died from alcoholism. There seems to be one key word running through this entire appendix, and that's the word change. Now, Bill, like all writers, repeats himself quite often, but also, like most good writers, when he repeats himself, he finds a different word which means the same thing, rather than repeat himself over and over using the same word. Let's look on page 569. Let's see how many times he said change and how many different ways he had of saying it. First paragraph, he talked about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. Second paragraph, he again mentioned personality changes, but then he said a nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. An upheaval is to change entirely. Third paragraph, first sentence, he said, sudden revolutionary changes. To revolutionize something is to change it entirely. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said, immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. To overwhelm is to change. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said, vast change in feeling and outlook. Fourth paragraph, first sentence, he said, such transformations. To transform is to change. About the middle of the fourth paragraph, he said, a profound alteration. To alter is to change. So the key to this whole thing is to change from what we were when we came here. Restless, irritable, discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Completely screwed up in our minds. To somebody that can be sober and peaceful and happy and free and have a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. Getting rid of selfishness. Trying to change and start helping others. Trying to do God's will instead of self-will. A complete change in our personality. That's what he means by spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. It has nothing at all to do with religion.
You got to be careful with this idea about change, because I told you earlier, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I stood in the back of the rooms and I looked down at my feet and I was ashamed of what I had become. And I did not want to be me. I wanted to be something different than what I was. So I looked around the fellowship and I found me some heroes. We all got to have our heroes for a while. One was George and the other was my sponsor, Franklin. And later on, Joe and Charlie became my heroes. And I emulated them in every way that I could. Almost made it. See, I was almost like Charlie. Thank God I didn't make it. One Charlie's enough. But the point is, I didn't like me, so I'm trying to be like my heroes, emulating them. And I think the type of change that they're in, that's not bad for a while. The type of change I think they really talk about in this book is to change from what I had become when I arrived here to that which God intends for me to be. That's a marvelous experience in life, to be who you are, just who you are, and not trying to be somebody else all the time. That's a good feeling. And that's the type of change I think they're talking about now. Let's go back to page 25.
We're going to run you over for just a few minutes, but that's okay. It won't take long. Mm-hmm. The last paragraph on page 25.
He said, if you're as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we'd passed into the region in which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
That's step one.
And the other, to accept spiritual help.
That's step two.
Didn't want to do either one of those. There's got to be an alternative. But there isn't. I had to make a choice between one of those. Either go out there and do the very best I can do, or to stay here and try to apply this program to my life. That seems to be the only choice we alcoholics have. Thank God I was able to stick around and to begin to apply these steps and these principles to my life. Because I am not what I used to be. I guarantee you on that. I'm just different. I'm becoming what God intended for me to be. And I like who I am today, and I can look you in the eye.
Well, one thing you hear quite often in AA today around in some of the meetings is you better not talk too much about God or you're going to run the newcomer off. But you'll notice the Big Book doesn't mind talking about God at all. The Big Book finally gets around to telling us we've only got one or two choices. We can continue as we are, drinking till the very end, step one, or we can accept spiritual help, step two. And it seems as though we don't have any other choices than that. My sponsor straightened me out on that when I came to AA. He said, Charlie, you don't have to worry about running the newcomer off talking about God. He said, if you do, whiskey will run him right back in here. He said he has no other place to go, and when he comes back, he's probably going to be willing to talk about God.
He's already been off in here.
Now, one other thing before we're through. Where did this idea come from? You know, you would have thought the idea of a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening would have come from somebody in religion. And when I look in the Big Book on page 26 and 27, and I see where this comes from, it absolutely amazes me every time I look at it. It said a certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character.
Roland Hazard.
This is Roland Hazard, the guy that helped Debbie Thatcher. For years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist, Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society. He would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you." Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. And he said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
Change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side.
Change.
And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them.
Change.
In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement
change.
Within you.
Change.
With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description, asterisk, bottom of the page, for amplification, see Appendix 2. This guy was one of the best known psychiatrists in the world at that time. There was Dr. Freud, there was Dr. Adler, and there was Dr. Jung. This guy had enough humility to be able to say to Roland, "Roland, I can't help you anymore. With all my knowledge of the mind, I can do nothing more for you. You're probably going to die from alcoholism." You know, he could have said, "Roland, I think you're suffering from a Valium deficiency. Let me write you a prescription and you keep coming back for another year." But he had enough honesty and enough humility to go outside of his field. Roland said, "Are there no exceptions to this deal?" And he said, "Oh yeah, yeah, once in a while. Once in a while. I've seen alcoholics of your type have a vital spiritual experience and recover from alcoholism." He said, "I don't understand it. It's a phenomenon to me, but I've seen it happen." And we know that Roland left Dr. Jung, came back to the States, got involved in the Oxford groups, used their program of action, had a spiritual experience, took that information to Abby Thatcher, and Abby Thatcher took it to Bill Wilson. And Bill applied the program of action. And Bill was able to recover from alcoholism. You know, we people in AA who are so proud of our 12 steps, and rightly we should be, I think sometimes, though, we need to look and see, where did these things come from to start with? Step one, the powerlessness, the physical allergy, the obsession of the mind. They came to us from a non-alcoholic doctor that lived in New York City named Dr. Silkworth. Step two, the solution, the spiritual experience. came to us from a non-alcoholic psychiatrist on the other side of the world. The last 10 steps, the program of action, came to us from a group of people who were non-alcoholics practicing first century Christianity. Bill always said, I knew none of these things. He said, my mind was used as a vessel. And all of these things gelled together in my head, and I was able to write the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we all need to remember, with gratitude, that these things came to us from non-alcoholics. We didn't know any of them. Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. One little bitty picture, and then we're going to
Silkworth, he identified what the problem was, but he didn't have a solution for it. Dr. Jung gave Roland the solution, but he didn't know what the problem was. The Oxford group wasn't involved in the problem at all, you see, but they had the solution. You know, look what happened. Back in those days, he said, here and there, just once in a great while, alcoholics have what are called vital spiritual experiences. And that's just here and there, once in a great while. Today, a wholesale miracle has happened in our lifetime, if you will, from that time till now. Because today, we can look around these rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous and say to you and to us, here and now, every time that you will apply these steps to your life, you too can recover. And they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. A miracle in our lifetime.
Yeah. Okay, this little picture, and then we'll finish up. We're talking about what is the solution. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the two powers. And on the left-hand side of the sheet up there, we see the power of the fellowship, which supports us. For the older members, through the sharing of their experience, strength, and hope, provides enough support to the new member to be able to stay sober for a period of time. And by the way, it's a two-way street. As the older member supports the new member, then the older member draws strength from that too. Great, great power in the fellowship. It would be almost impossible today to be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous very long and not begin to believe there's some power greater than human power working within this thing. When you hear tens and hundreds and thousands of people say it's only by the grace of God, or because of a power greater than I am, or because of God as I understand Him, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in X number of days, weeks, months, years, or whatever it might be. You can hardly hear that over and over and over and see it and not begin to believe in some kind of power greater than human power. Now, the instant the newcomer begins to believe in that power, then that opens up the mind. And the newcomer becomes willing to investigate. And upon investigation, we find that simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as the newcomer begins to apply the 12 steps, then they begin to change their personality. And eventually it results in the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, which revolutionizes their whole attitude toward life, toward their fellows, and toward God's universe. The personality change to be sufficient to recover from alcoholism. When that happens to the newcomer, then they become an older member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they can go back to the left-hand side of the sheet. And they can support the next newcomer that comes in. And we're basing older membership not on how long we've been sober, but on whether we've had the spiritual experience or not. You know, there was a time in AA when everybody was expected to work the program. Everybody was expected to have the spiritual awakening or spiritual experience, whichever one it might be. Those that didn't want to do that, they were told, quite frankly, well, you might as well leave here. Because there's nothing we can do for you unless you're willing to work the program and change. But as time went by, we began to change from quality of sobriety to quantity of sobriety. We begin to lay this book down. We begin to push the program away. We begin to work it any way we wanted to. We begin to stay sober more and more and more on fellowship. The instant we did that, we went from a life-changing program to a non-drinking program. Then in self-defense, we had to measure success by how long have you been sober, rather than by the quality of that sobriety. And today in AA, you see all kinds of people. Sometimes you see somebody in AA that's only been in here about 6 months. They got a good sponsor. They got right into the program. They have had a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. You just love to be around them. They're always laughing and cutting up and having fun and helping other people and doing everything they can for AA. Only been sober about 6 months. You see, other people have been sober 7, 8, 9, 10 years. They've treated it like a cafeteria. They took what they wanted, and they left what they wanted. Now, they're better off than they used to be, but you never know what kind of shape they're going to be in the next time you run into them. One day they're up, and the next day they're down. They're kind of like a yo-yo going back and forth. Then you see some people in AA that's been sober 15, 16, 18, 20, and 25 years. Never worked a step. Damn proud of it. And they're the ones that say, by God, if you want what we've got, and are willing to go to any damn lengths to get it. You know. Some of those guys feel so bad you'd like to buy them a drink. You know, damn good and well they would feel better with a drink. So we're not talking about how long have we been sober. We're talking about the quality of that sobriety. Only those that have had a spiritual experience can help the next one have a spiritual experience. And again, that's what sponsorship is about. So we see the two powers. The two powers added together will be the solution to the powerless condition. Enough power to overcome alcoholism. Thank you all for being here tonight. We've enjoyed it. We hope you have.
O.M., Joem, and Charlie, welcome them.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Charlie Parmit. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 11,517 days today, one day at a time. For this, I'm grateful. Joe leaned over here a while ago and whispered in my ear, and he said, Charlie, isn't this the greatest looking bunch of sick people you've ever seen? You all do look great this morning. We're going to start out by telling a little joke this morning. We kind of like to do that, you know, once in a while, and one of my favorites, and many of you have heard it before, but I'm going to tell it anyhow.
He likes the way he tells it.
It's a story about the brain surgeon. The brain surgeon had found a way to transplant the human brain in its entirety. Been doing it several years with other organs of the body. He figured out a way to do it with the brain. This older fellow went to see the surgeon. And he said, Doctor, I've been having problems with my brain. I can't remember anything. I can't think well anymore. I can't figure things out. Do you think you might be able to help me? The surgeon said, well, let's give you a good physical examination. We'll see if your body's okay first. Checked him out, gave him a good physical, and he said, oh, yeah, your body's in great shape. Said, I believe I could transplant a brain into your head and everything would be just fine. The old man said, well, great, what do you have to offer? The doctor said, well, let's go up in the display room and I'll show you what we've got in stock at the present time. They went up in a display room, and he said, now, in this case over here, I have the brains of an attorney. Said, I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be just fine. It would cost you $10,000. The old man said, well, do you have anything else? And he said, oh, yeah. In this case over here, he said, I have the brains of a doctor. Said, I transplant this in your head. Everything would be fine. Cost you $20,000. The old man said, well, do you have anything else? And he said, oh, yeah. In this case over here, I have the brains of an alcoholic. Said, I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be great. It'll cost you $50,000. The old man said, I don't understand this deal at all. $10,000 for the attorney's brain, $20,000 for the doctor's brain and $50,000 for the alcoholic brain. The doctor said, well, hell yes, man. It's brand new. It's never been used before.
I like that story about this couple traveling out here on Highway 95. Highway Patrol pulled him over, and he walked up to the window and said, sir, I'm going to have to give you a ticket for speeding. He said, no, I was not speeding. I had my cruise control set right on the speed limit, and I'm not speeding. His wife said, no, that's not true. I told you way back there to slow down or you're going to get a ticket. He said, you shut up. I'll deal with you and I'll get you home. The highway patrol said, yes, sir, and you don't have your seatbelt on either. I'm going to have to give you a ticket for not having your seatbelt on. He said, I had my seatbelt on. I took it loose because I know you'd want to see my driver's license. And she said, now, that's not true. I told you way back there to slow down and put your seatbelt on or you're going to get a ticket. He said, you shut up. I'll deal with you and I'll get you home. The highway patrol said, ma'am, does he always talk to you like this? She said, only when he's drinking. You read this now?
Okay, now Joe's going to read the preamble.
My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
My name is Joe.
And I've been sober ever since I quit drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Great. Thank you, Joe. Yeah. Joe?
My name is Joe. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
As we come back this morning, we're coming back to a big book, to the plan of the book. We've established a problem as powerless because of allergy and obsession and the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. Begin to look at part of the solution, step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity as a solution. And when chapter two explained to us what that power was, the power of the fellowship and the power of the spiritual experience, which would produce the psychic change. This morning we are more about alcoholism. You know, we read step two. Step two says, came to believe that this power could restore us to sanity. And to me, more about alcoholism is all about the insanity of alcoholism. And we begin with this on page.
You know, many alcoholics are highly offended when you bring up this idea of insanity. You know, if we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, that would indicate then we must be insane. And many alcoholics say, oh, no, I'm not insane. Yeah, I do some pretty crazy, stupid things while drinking, but when I'm sober, I'm much like other people. Many alcoholics, when you bring this idea up, they'll say, well, I don't have any trouble with that insanity because I remember all the crazy, stupid things I did while drunk. In either case, they're referring to the insanity as the crazy, stupid things we do when drunk. No, that's not insanity. All the crazy, stupid things we do while drunk is caused by a mind filled with alcohol, and alcohol lowers the inhibitions. And if your mind is filled with something that lowers the inhibitions, sure enough, you're going to do some pretty crazy, stupid things. But that's not insanity. That's caused by alcohol itself. In order for us to really understand this, once again, we had to go back to the dictionary. We went back to the dictionary and we looked up the word sane or sanity. And to be sane is defined as wholeness of mind. If your mind is complete, if your mind is whole, you can pretty well see the truth about everything around you. You make decisions based on truth, and life usually turns out pretty good. An insane mind is simply one that is less than whole. And a mind that is less than whole cannot always see the truth about everything around it. makes a decision based upon a lie, and eventually life becomes an absolute living hell under those conditions. To be insane does not mean you're crazy. We get those two words mixed up. If you're crazy, that means you've lost more than half your marbles, and you got to be locked up somewhere to protect you and society from you. To be insane does not mean that you're crazy. It means that you're just less than whole, period. Now, if we make a decision based upon a lie, invariably we're always going to run into the truth, and then the truth is going to determine what our life is going to become. So what we're going to really look at in this chapter is not what we do when we're drinking, but the state of the mind just prior to the first drink. Can we see the truth, or can we not see the truth? If we can see the truth, we're sane. If we can't see the truth, we're insane. You know, one of the best ways I know of to describe this, the difference between insanity and crazy, is let's take a pie, let's set it here in front of us, and let's cut it into 10 pieces. You come along and I give you a piece of pie. My pie is now less than whole, but I've still got 90% of it. Somebody else comes along, I give them a piece of pie. My pie is still more less than whole, but I've still got 80% of it. To be insane does not mean that you're all gone. It just means you're not quite all here. And when it comes to alcohol, it seems as though from time to time, we are not quite all here, because we cannot see the truth about alcohol, Joe.
Okay. More about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we are real alcoholics. Well, a person likes to think he is bodily or mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learn we had to fully concede to our innermost selves we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The illusion that we will be like other people in prison has to be smashed. Now here, Bill begins his little word games. It seems confusing sometimes to the reader, but he likes to use the, he doesn't like when he preaches himself, he uses a different word. It seems like he's saying a lot of different things, but he's saying the same thing over and over. And here he begins to talk about it. His idea that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession. Obsession is an idea that overcomes all of the ideas. Obsession can make you believe something that's not true. Okay, the persistence of this illusion. Illusion is to see something that's not there. And that can make you believe something that's not true. Same as obsession. We can see the animal cells. This is the, he said, delusion. Then down now, he said, the delusion that we are like other people present has to be smashed. Whether we say insanity, obsession, illusion, or delusion, they're all the same. It's the state of the mind that we're in just before we drink. Not after we drink. We're insane. We're not whole. We can't see the truth. Just before we drink. See, we can't, if we are alcoholics, we can't drink on the truth. We have to drink on the lie. Because as long as you see the truth about what you're about to do, you won't do it. But we drink on the lie. See, this morning, if I was to walk over there in the bar and take a drink, I'd have to go over there on the truth. It's pretty hard for me to go over there on the truth. I'd have to go over there and say, Mister, I ain't had none of that in almost 39 years, and damn near killed me the last time. My wife left me. I ended up locked up in the nut house and almost lost my job and everything I had. And this morning I got some money. I'm going to buy some more of that stuff and do the same damn thing. It's very difficult to drink. I have to say, well, this time it's going to be different, which is a lie. Okay. So he begins by, this is the insanity of alcoholism, and it's going to take this chapter is going to be a series of, he teaches with a series of stories, all about the same thing with different, the man of 30, Jim, Fred, the jaywalker. All of us are going to be looking at one thing. He's going to repeat these stories over and over to show us the state of the mind just before we drink.
Well, yeah, I love this chapter more about alcoholism because I understand this morning why it's where it is.
Yeah.
Ebby presented Bill with a solution, and just like the book just presented us with a solution. And Bill didn't like that solution any more than we did. I didn't particularly like the solution either. But he told us a little bit more about alcoholism, more about what's going to happen to us unless we can see the truth. This chapter heading could be called More Truth About Alcoholism, because I need to see the truth. It's only the truth, as Joe said, that's going to help me. And see, I've always known all my life and heard all my life, if you know the truth will set you free.
Sure.
And if you're not free, it's because you don't know the truth. And see, I need to know the truth. And so he's going to tell us some more truth about alcoholism. He, as they said, these ideas and these words that they use are all meant to be the same thing. The obsession is an idea that overpowers all other ideas. A few months ago, I looked up these words in the dictionary, and they're kind of interesting. If you don't mind, I'll read them. Obsession. Not only is it an idea that overcomes all other ideas, it said obsession is a disturbing preoccupation with an idea or a feeling. Mm-hmm. Insanity, foolish, not mentally sound. Illusion, a mistaken idea. Delusion, a persistent belief in something false, typical of some mental disorders. Doesn't that all sound like the same thing to me? We have to be able to see the truth, and this chapter helps us to see truth about alcoholism, which will set us free from the illness of alcoholism.
So we're going to look at the obsession, the illusion, the delusion, or the insanity regarding alcohol itself. Now, later on, I realized I wasn't too swift in a hell of a lot of areas when I got to AA. But the only one we're concerned with right now in this chapter is alcohol itself. Can we or can we not see the truth about alcohol? We've always got to remember that just before we take the first drink, we are stone cold sober. No alcohol in our system at all. And can we see the truth about it or not whenever we're stone cold sober? Now, he's going to teach us this information through using a series of examples, which is one of the greatest ways to teach. He's going to talk about the man of 30. He's going to talk about a fellow named Jim. He's going to talk about the jaywalker. And he's going to talk about a fellow named Fred. And each time we're going to look into the mind just immediately prior to taking the first drink. Can we or can we not see the truth? We can see the truth, we're sane. If we can't, we're insane. Let's go over to page 32. The first example we're going to look at is a man of 30.
So the man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind, pulled out old Will and said, sick him, Will. Said, made up his mind that until he'd been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man. He remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and the bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. Now, he tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem which money could buy was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Now, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we're in a short time as bad as ever. Now, if we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservations of any kind or any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol.
We know the truth to be this. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. We've never yet seen one single case where we could go back to safe drinking. Now, if we can see the truth, then we're sane. If we can't, we're insane. Is this man a 30? Is his real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol? But he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol after 25 years of sobriety. He believed something that wasn't true. He believed a lie. He made a decision based upon the lie, took the action, took a drink, and then after the alcohol hit his system, the allergy took over. He was unable to stop drinking, and within a short period of time, relatively short period of time, he was dead from alcoholism. But his real problem is not the physical allergy. His real problem is the inability to see the truth. Insanity as far as alcohol is concerned. Let's go over to page 34. Second paragraph. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. Now this Joe just loves Jim. He gets a little screwed up with him once in a while. Let's see what we can do with Jim this morning, Joe.
Jim's my main man. Me and him think a lot alike. My first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He has a commendable world record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him.
Typical alcoholic, isn't he? Yeah, you betcha.
He's a good salesman. Okay. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He didn't know drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the treatment center, he came into contact with us. They changed the name of those places, they call them different. Same thing. Now, we told him what we knew about alcoholism.
They told him about step one.
Told him about the problem. And the answer they had found.
They told him about step two.
And he made a beginning.
A little later on in the book, we're going to see where step three is but a beginning. So apparently Jim took steps one, two, and three. And immediately, things began to get better for him.
And we still see that today. People coming in taking one, two, and three, and it won't go any further. Hey, it's getting like a tap dance. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, as far as they go. Okay. His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman he had lost through drinking. All went well, but he failed to enlarge on his spiritual life.
A little later on, we're going to see the only way you enlarge on step three is through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Jim didn't do any of those. Just 1, 2, and 3.
To his consternation, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times in rapid succession. He got drunk 6 times real quick. And these were good AA members. On each occasion, we worked with him. We were very careful what had happened. They went over each time he got drunk, and they worked with him, tried to help him. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in a serious condition. He knew he'd face another trip to the treatment center if he kept on.
He always does it right here at this point.
He would lose his family, whom he had deep affection.
You know, these guys were really, really good AA members.
Yeah, they were good. They fooled with him. I doubt they fooled with you that much now. You know, they don't fool with you no 6 times. They get tired of fooling with you.
But they're getting a little tired of him now.
Yeah, he got drunk again. Now, this is 7 times. Now, we asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. I said, Jim, look. Man, we've been over here 7 times fooling with you. How are you getting drunk? Now, this is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. Read the book many years before we saw that Tuesday morning.
Came to work on Tuesday morning.
Well, with Jim, Monday. You know, we're bad about Monday. It does say Tuesday now.
Okay, now we're going to look into Jim's mind. Just before he took the first drink, when he was stone cold sober.
I remember I felt irritated. I had to be a Selma concern I once owned.
Now, I don't think there's any insanity there. That's probably normal. I think any of us that had to work for be a salesman for a concern we once owned, we probably would be a little bit irritated by that too. I think that's normal thinking. No insanity yet.
Okay. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. The
boss probably said, say, Jim, by the way, where were you all day Monday anyhow? Nothing real serious. Just enough to get him a little bit irritated.
Then I decided driving the country and see all my prospects for a car.
What would be more normal? And if you're a car salesman, you've had a few words with the boss, you want to get away from the shop for a while, you drive out in the country, and you want to see somebody you already know to try to sell a car to them. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they had a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich.
What's more normal than if you're hungry? To stop in a place to get a sandwich. The fact that they have a bar is beside the point. We have no intention of drinking at all. We're just hungry. We're going to get a sandwich. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
I also had a notion I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was for me. I've been going there for years and eating there many times during the months I was sober.
What's more normal than to think, while I'm in there, I might find another customer for a car? I'm not going in there to drink anyhow. I'm going in there to get a sandwich and try to sell a car. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
I sat at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk.
What's more normal than to sit down at a table, order a sandwich and a glass of milk? Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
Still don't throw out drinking, I order another sandwich and decide to have another glass of milk.
If you're hungry enough. There's nothing wrong with 2 sandwiches and 2 glasses of milk. Unless you're a member of Overeaters Anonymous. If you are, you ought to look at that. But 2 sandwiches and 2 glasses of milk, that's normal, sane thinking for a hungry, alcoholic car salesman. No insanity there.
Okay, now the squiggly writing.
Squiggly writing starts now.
That's italic.
Suddenly the thought crossed my mind, if I were to put 1 ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
Now, this is absolute insanity. For this guy to believe he can take 1 ounce of whiskey and mix it with milk, and it won't hurt him on a full stomach. Now, based on the insane idea, he now makes a decision and takes some action.
I ordered the whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt assured that I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured that in the milk. That didn't bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the treatment center for Jim.
You gonna be all right?
I guess we're laughing at ourselves.
You want me to read it?
Yeah,
you
go ahead.
Joe, you better read.
That started one more journey to this island for Jim. Here was a threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which the drinking always caused him. Now, he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in the favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. I think if you mix that much whiskey with 8 or 10 glasses of milk, there's going to be some other problems you're going to have, too. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. Here's a definition of insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? A great definition of insanity. The lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else. See, Jim was restless, irritable, and discontented. And when he suddenly got the idea, that means right now, suddenly, if I take a drink and mix it with milk, it won't hurt me on a full stomach. Plain insanity.
Now, is old Jim's real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol? The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, telling us we can drink, rather than in the body that ensures that we can't drink. A form of insanity, an obsession, an illusion, or a delusion. In each case, we believe that lie. Now, you may think this is an extreme case. To us, it's not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened. In some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we're obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. And even when we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, always, I would say to myself, well, hell, I might as well go get drunk as feel the way I'm feeling now. Couldn't make me feel any worse. And I'd end up drunk and in all kinds of trouble and come out of that mess feeling a hell of a lot worse than I did before I started that drunk. Always believed the lie, though, just before I took the first drink. You know, I've heard many, many alcoholics say, I'm going to go out and have a couple of drinks and have a good time. I have never yet heard one say, I'm going to go out and have a couple of drinks and have a car wreck. I've never heard one say, I'm going to have 2 drinks and end up in a jailhouse tonight. Always, we believe the lie that this time, it's going to be different.
That's the trouble with trouble. It always starts out as fun, doesn't it?
Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. Now, I don't understand this guy at all, but I can see him out here on the interstate waiting for a big bus or a truck to come down through there. jumps out in front of it, spins around two or three times, sees how close it can come to hitting him without actually hitting him. For some reason, he gets a thrill out of that. Don't understand him, but I can see him doing it. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. People are saying, hey, Bill, you better quit doing that. You're going to get hurt if you keep it up. He pays no attention to them. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he's slightly injured several times in succession. He's getting a little older now. He can't move as fast. They begin to hit him once in a while. Nothing serious. He just kind of bounces off of him. Now, you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out.
Abnormal.
But presently, he's hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. He got hurt pretty bad this time. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He gets hurt pretty bad again. Now, he sings their national anthem. He tells you he decided to stop jaywalking for good. He said, man, I'm tired of these fractured skulls and broken arms. I'll never jaywalk again as long as I live. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. Now, on through the years, this conduct continues. Accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. He's just beat up now. He can't hold a job. His wife gets a divorce. She's tired of supporting him and the kids and all the hospital bills. And he's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Not his body, his head. He shuts himself up in a treatment center, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Now, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous. But is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? I think that is so appropriate today. You know, once again, because of education, people are getting it to us before they have to lose anything and everything that they've got. You know, once in a while, people come to us and they've still got a job. Occasionally, somebody comes in and they're still married. Hell, I saw one not long ago come in, and he still owned an automobile. He really did. And we start talking to those people about insanity, and they say, man, don't tell me I'm crazy. I've still got my job. I've got my family. I've still got my car. No, we're not talking about those things at all. We're talking about one thing and one thing only. Can we or can we not see the truth about alcohol? If we can, we're sane. If we can't, we're insane. Now, I think the person who has lost all perhaps can see the truth a little easier and a little faster than the one who's lost nothing. But in either case, in order to get drunk, we have to believe a lie before we take a drink, before we take the first drink. We're going to look at an example of a guy now who's a high-bottom drunk, who's never lost anything, period, from drinking, yet he's alcoholic, and he ends up getting drunk just exactly like Jim did. Jim had lost everything. The next guy, we're going to find, hasn't lost anything at all.
You know, we see a lot of people coming into AA today, and they haven't lost everything, and sometimes we start telling them some of those horror stories that we have, all of us, and eventually they will say to themselves, well, hell, I didn't go to jail 59 times. I haven't been married and divorced to two women 7 times, so I may not be alcoholic. Well, you see, I know today that none of those things has anything to do with being alcoholic, but we have to present that information to them so they can make a decision, too.
Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we've not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well that what you've told us that such things cannot happen again. We've not lost everything in life through drinking. We certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information.
Kiss
I remember the day I told them that, too. Just exactly. Now, that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. We talked about the heavy drinker already. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hearted exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers that has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. Now we're going to look at a guy named Fred. And Fred has never lost anything because of his drinking. The day Fred gets drunk, he's on top of the world, he's feeling great, he's floating along, and everything is just fine. Now, it seems as though we alcoholics, when we feel bad, we drink to feel better. But when we feel good, we drink to feel better yet. Let's take a look at Fred, Joe.
See, Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married, and father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearances, he's a stable and well-balanced individual. Yet, he's an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he'd gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves.
We see lots of nerve resters in AA today, just like old Fred.
The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. Now, he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic.
He would not take step one.
Much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem.
If you can't take one, you certainly can't take step two.
Now, we told him what we knew about alcoholism. They told him about the doctor's opinion and the obsession of the mind. He was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms. But he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. Now, we heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told is most instructive. For here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment, determination, and all his other concerns, yet he was flat on his back nevertheless. Well, let him tell you about it. He said, I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. And I rather appreciate your ideas about the subtle insanity, the information about the obsession of the mind, which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I'd learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. Now, in that frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks, and I began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. We think he started getting drunk right here because his mind began to play with him. It's not as bad as I thought. One day I went to the Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Fred was doing good, wasn't he? Making good money, living good, family was happy, everything was going wonderful for Fred.
Charlie. Okay. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. And I swear they're writing. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind, it'd be nice to have a couple of cocktails and go to the hospital. What a great day. I believe I'll go to the hospital.
Now, that's the truth,
isn't it?
That's the truth. No way could he drink on the truth. So his mind simply said it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. Now, based on the insane idea, He makes a decision, takes some action. I ordered a cocktail in my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. Now, the allergy's taking over now. No way can we stop. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. You know, Jim, he vaguely sensed he wasn't being any too smart. Fred didn't even sense that. Fred just thought a couple of cocktails with dinner would be great, that's all. And he took a drink based on the insane idea, triggered the allergy, couldn't stop drinking, ended up back in the hospital. Now, it's his real problem. The fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol. The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind telling us we can drink rather than in the body that ensures that we can't drink. Let's go over to page 43, last paragraph. Joe?
Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in few rare cases where he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
And if you'll notice there, in that last paragraph, he didn't say the drinking alcoholic. He didn't say the practicing alcoholic. He just said the alcoholic. And what that means to me today is I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. My defense must come from a power greater than human power.
It also said that we have this idea that we could stay sober on self-knowledge had to be smashed. Self-knowledge is good. It helps us see the truth about our condition. Very, very important. But Bill tried to stay sober on self-knowledge, you know, and he left there. He said, you know, now that I know what's wrong with me, I think I can stay sober. So he tried to stay sober on self-knowledge. Roland tried to stay sober on self-knowledge. Jim tried to stay sober on self-knowledge, and he got drunk again. Fred tried to stay sober on self-knowledge, and he got drunk again. And they just told us through these four illustrations, a man of 30, Jim, Jay Walker, and Fred again. Now he told us four times. Now he's going to tell us once more. See? Sure that we understand what he's been saying to us. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. See, I know today you can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. You can't think your way out of it. The more you try to think your way out of it, the deeper in it you get. Our defense must come from a higher power.
Now, what he's really done to me in this chapter, he's now closed the door on me. You see, in the doctor's opinion in Bill's story, I was allowed to see what the problem is, the physical allergy, the obsession of the mind. In chapter 2, I was allowed to see what the solution is, the power of the fellowship and the power of the vital spiritual experience, the finding of the power greater than human power, or God as I understand him. Bill had a lot of problem with this idea of the higher power. Most other alcoholics had problems with it. He knew we were going to have a problem with it too. So in chapter 3, more about alcoholism, he told us just exactly what's going to happen to us if we don't find that power greater than human power. That because of our insanity, we're going to end up going right back to drinking. So he closed the door on me in chapter 3, and when he did, at the end of chapter 3, I am now faced with one hell of a dilemma. because he's convinced me through chapter 3 that if I don't find that power greater than human power, then sooner or later I'm going to go back to drinking. Also, I was convinced at the end of chapter 3 that I would be unable to find that power. Based upon what I had been during my years of drinking, I knew that if God had anything to do with me, it sure as hell wasn't going to be anything good. Because you see, I was raised in a good old Southern Baptist church. Now, I don't have anything against a good old Southern Baptist church. I think it's a fine church. But as a kid growing up in that good old Southern Baptist church, I'm quite sure from time to time they talked about a kind and a loving God. But if they did, that message never got to the pew that I sat in. Because all I ever remember hearing about God in church was hellfire and brimstone, going to hell for lying, cheating, stealing, drinking whiskey, and committing adultery. By the time I got to AA, I'd been doing that for about 26 years, and I knew that God had already told St. Peter, when that little four-eyed sucker gets up here, send him downstairs. We'll not need his kind. I remember so clearly, as a kid growing up, when I got separated from this God thing anyhow. You know, when I went to church as a kid, they told me what I could do and what I couldn't do. They said, if you do this, this, and this, you'll be okay. If you do that, that, and that, you're going to hell just as sure as anything. And I had no trouble with what they told me until I got to be about 12 or 13 years old. And one day it seemed as though the minister looked me straight in the eye. And he said, to think about doing it is just as bad as doing it. And I said, oh, shit, I've had it now. Because I'd been thinking about doing it for about a year.
A lot.
In fact, I'd been thinking about doing it so much I was beginning to get a little brain damage from it. And I said to myself, well, if you're going to go to hell for thinking about doing it, then you just might as well go ahead and do it. And I did it. And I didn't go to hell immediately. And I said, that sucker has been lying to me all along. I made up my mind that day that that minister and my parents and my teachers had joined together in a conspiracy to keep me from having a good time. And I said to myself, to hell with them. From now on, I'm going to do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it. I'm going to have a good time and enjoy myself. And if they don't like it, that's tough. I walked away from all parental control, all teacher control, and all relationships with God, period, and said, from now on, I'm going to do it my way, period. When I got to AA, I was 40 years old. I got here in the body of an adult with the spiritual knowledge and makeup of a 12-year-old kid when he walked away from church back when he was small. No wonder we have trouble with this God thing. No wonder we have trouble with it. And Bill knew the problems I was going to have. And I think Bill said to himself, I've given them the problem, I've given them the solution, I've told them what's going to happen to them if they don't find that solution. Now I'm going to have to start giving them a solution that they can live with. Because he knew, based upon my old ideas, that I'd never be able to make a decision regarding this God thing. And he sat down and he wrote another chapter. And he wrote it just for me. And he called it, We Agnostics. And I really believe what happened to me through this chapter, We Agnostics, is Bill gave me some new ideas about God. Some new ideas that I could think upon and ponder about. And eventually take these new ideas and replace the old ideas. And then I could make a decision about God. You see, the very next thing I've got to do is deal with step 3. And it's impossible for me to make that decision based upon the old ideas. Thank God for chapter 4 in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, Joe.
We got to flip the